It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a new theater collaboration in Milwaukee.
First, President Obama has rejected plans for the Keystone XL pipeline after a seven-year review process. Here's his announcement on the decision this morning.
This morning, Secretary Kerry informed me that after extensive public outreach and consultation with other cabinet agencies, the State Department has decided that the Keystone XL pipeline would not serve the national interests of the United States. I agree with that decision.
The proposed pipeline would have carried 800,000 barrels of oil a day, nearly 1,200 miles from Canada to the Gulf Coast. It's been a major point of contention in the broader debate about energy, the climate, and the economy.
The president's decision also comes less than a month before a major summit in Paris focused on fighting climate change and global warming.
Alana Shore joins us now. She's an energy reporter for Politico. Alana, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So a long-awaited decision. Was it a surprise that we heard this decision today?
Absolutely not. The president has signaled for months that he intends to reject this pipeline. What today was just doing this at the best possible time for his climate change agenda. He's about to go to United Nations talks in Paris at the end of the month, and it's really strengthened his ability to get other nations on board for a big deal.
So that's to an international audience. How did he make the case on this decision to the domestic audience here at home?
Well, what Paris is all about, it sounds international, but it's really about American climate change progress. It's sort of in line with what the president has been talking about through his EPA rules for power plants trying to cut U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. It's all part of recognizing that climate change is a global issue, and he wants to get serious about it from America's perspective as one of the world's biggest emitters. What he also did was he kind of gave a stiff arm to a lot of pro-Keystone forces, talk of major job creation and major positive impacts on gasoline prices, because, to be frank, the State Department's own review didn't find much evidence of that.
I'm wondering why Keystone, because some people have observed, as you just said, there will be jobs or would be jobs, but not that many jobs in the scope of things. There will be an environmental impact, but there are other things that have bigger environmental impacts. Why did this pipeline proposal become such a topic, such a hot topic in this debate?
Well, we're about to run a pretty book-length magnum opus on Politico about this, but I'll try to summarize it in one sentence, and that is, the environmental movement was licking its wounds 5 years ago after it lost what we call the cap-and-trade fight in Washington, basically a really arcane climate change bill that would have done a lot of what the president is now doing through regulation. So when environmentalists lost 5 years ago, they regrouped and they thought, you know, like, we need to pick a fight we can really win. And Keystone ended up being that fight. People think of the environmental movement in America as kind of dead since the 60s and 70s, but they have gotten a huge shot in the arm today.
Talking to Alana Shore with Politico about today's announcement that the Keystone XL pipeline is off, done, well, at least for now. Well, what does this mean for the political presidential debate? Republican candidates all rallied in favor of Keystone so far on the campaign. Democratic candidates, Hillary Clinton, in some cases, an awkward position because there are Democrats who supported this plan. Where does it go now?
Well, I hate to tell your listeners who are probably kind of tired of hearing about this, but I think it'll come back in a big way in the general election next year because, as you pointed out, you've got diametrically opposed parties now that Hillary Clinton is out against Keystone. Every Democrat is against it, and every Republican thinks the president just made a huge mistake. So I think you'll hear a lot of the same arguments you heard in 2012 and 2014, because the truth is, the issues this pipeline symbolized, even though it was just one project, namely energy independence, you know, moving off of oil, foreign imports, are going to stay live. So we're going to keep talking about this.
One criticism of this decision has been, hey, this oil is up there in Canada, the tar sands. Doesn't mean it's not going to be tapped. It doesn't mean it's not going to be exploited and ultimately used. It could just go somewhere else. Is that maybe the end result of this?
I wouldn't be so quick to say that anymore, and that's just because of what's happening with oil prices. No one on Wall Street expects oil to get back to the $100 a barrel price it was a year and a half ago, and even $80 seems like a dream at this point. And the fact about that heavy oil in Canada is that it's really expensive to produce. So if we're going to see prices depressed, we're going to see the Canadian economy suffer and not as much of that oil coming out of the ground. But that doesn't have a lot to do with Keystone, actually. It's really just economics.
I've seen another economic argument today along the lines of, hey, there's a structural change going on in the way we use oil, especially maybe here in the United States and Europe. Gradually, cars are becoming more energy efficient, trucks too. The demand maybe isn't going to keep going up and up and up like it has in the past.
Well, I mean, I think that's another piece of this, and that's another factor external to Washington that really swung in environmentalist favor. You know, they ran a savvy political campaign. They know how to tweet and stage a protest, but fundamentally, they lucked into a really favorable economic environment to say no to this heavy oil. Back when oil was so expensive 4 years ago, back when gas prices were above $3.50 a gallon, this would have been way harder to say no to.
I want to turn to the wider issues around climate change and listen to the president. This is, again, in his announcement today, saying this is about being a leader in taking on climate change.
America is now a global leader when it comes to taking serious action to fight climate change. And frankly, approving this project would have undercut that global leadership.
Climate change, a debate in Washington, maybe more so than in any other country. There's a debate over whether climate change is a thing at all in the first place. Is this a stronger action than we've seen on a climate change related issue in recent years in Washington?
Yeah, well, I mean, let's be clear. You know, science shows that the climate is changing, and what people are really debating is the impact that human activity has on that. So, I mean, the president has clearly put all his chips on the environmentalist dime, you know, and he's just making a big bet that history will sort of vindicate his approach. Obviously, Republicans think that's extremely foolish and that human activity is questionable how significantly it impacts the climate. But, you know, we talk about Paris, and it's easy for Americans and Wisconsinites to think, oh, what do I care? But the truth is that, you know, India, China, America are all trying to step up, you know, within the limits of their own internal politics. And I think the degree to which people care about that just depends on the degree to which you believe in the science. So we've got a lot of many debates here just converging on this pipeline.
Looking at this meeting in Paris, a lot of observers have been underwhelmed by international agreements related to climate change in the past. Is there a sense, is there momentum that something significant is going to come out of this?
Well, there are arguments on both sides of that. The first one is that, you know, most scientists working on this issue say we've got to keep temperature rises to about 2 degrees Celsius, you know, which is just a fancy way of saying there's a tipping point, right? And the commitments that nations around the world, including China and India, have made ahead of Paris get us to about 2.7. That is short of what scientists tell us we need to do. You can look at that and say, well, it's bound to be a failure. That said, the very fact that you've got America, India, and China, the biggest emitters in the world, coming to the table and really willing to rein in their industry's emissions, that's never happened before. So the previous skepticism has to be thrown out the window to a certain extent.
You mentioned earlier that this decision might in part be an effort to show the United States is serious on climate change going into this meeting. Do you think that message will be heard by China, India, and other countries that, hey, the U.S. Has thrown a big chip into the bucket here, maybe we should too?
I think they'll hear it. Whether that makes their bids going into Paris, which starts in just a couple weeks, any stronger than they already are, that's questionable.
Alana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was energy reporter Alana Shore with Politico, bringing us up to speed on President Obama's decision today to reject plans for the Keystone XL oil pipeline. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
Earlier this month, the Milwaukee Repertory Theater announced that it would host the Bronzeville Arts Ensemble in residency for the upcoming season.
Joining us to discuss the partnership and what it means for the African American Theater Company is Melkia Stampley, producing artistic director for the Bronzeville Arts Ensemble. Melkia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm guessing many of our listeners are familiar with the Milwaukee Rep, but maybe not as familiar with Bronzeville. Can you tell us a little bit about your company?
Sure. We are an ensemble of six artists. There are eight founders. We came together in 2013 to address the lack of black theater in Milwaukee and to add to the rich stories through the African-American lens. And our company, we want to have a community impact and also bring to the community wonderful theatrical productions as well.
And so tell us about the current state of African-American-led theater companies across the country.
So, according to the American Theater Magazine, racial relations have become increasingly strained throughout our country, and coupled with that, African American theater companies, their budgets are strained, and they're losing funding, and we're at a crisis point, I do believe. And so there are those that have been going strong, like Penumbra or St. Louis Black Repertory Theater or Crossroads in New Jersey. But there is still a need to continue adding to the community, to the American theater community, and to make sure that African American directors, producers, and writers are still that they still have a platform to create art.
How do you compare the efforts to support and establish and continue these African American-led theater companies to efforts to bring more diversity into all theater companies?
Well, I think they go hand in hand. An example being us being here at Milwaukee Rep. Our company is young, we're new, so we're not able to afford to do August Wilson yet or Raisin in the Sun. But we are able to do a production like The Mojo and the Say-So, a production that maybe the Rep it may not be interested in, but it's still an important story that for us we can still bring to the community with a much smaller budget. So there's a great opportunity for us to work together with larger budget or arts organizations to help increase their diversity efforts while supporting the work that they're already doing.
You said that Bronzeville, for instance, right now can't afford to do some of these better known, more established plays. What is it that costs money to put on one of those plays like A Raisin in the Sun?
It can be pretty complex, one actor's productions like those usually demand a large cast, and so then you're dealing with that. You need to then maybe pull from Chicago or New York, and those actors may be union actors, so those fees, the royalty fees to produce the play, the sets, all of those different components, and then of course the marketing part of it as well. And so when you're dealing with new works or lesser known works, you have a little bit more creativity to make the dollar stretch.
We're talking with Malkia Stampley, who is producing artistic director for the Bronzeville Arts Ensemble, which has just announced a new collaboration with the Milwaukee Rep. Now, in a press release, the Rep's artistic director, Mark Clemens, said that the partnership offers value to both parties. It sounds like there are some kind of infrastructure advantages for Bronzeville, but what do you see Bronzeville being able to bring to the Rep?
Well, we're able to be a resource for Milwaukee Rep. Myself and most of our ensemble members are Milwaukee natives. And so I grew up in one of the most disadvantaged zip code areas in Wisconsin, 53206. And yet I still call myself a product of theater. So the insight and the connections that I have from my community and also the arts community where I feel like I also grew up as well, I'm able to bring that to the Rep staff and as well as the rest of our ensemble. And we're also looking for ways that we can work together as an organization to help them, introduce them to the African American, different pockets of the community that they are still new to, and for us to also then introduce different arts and different ways to collaborate with artists.
So you are a lifelong resident of Milwaukee. You're a person of color. You're also an artist. Why is it important for Milwaukee to have access to something like the Bronzeville Arts Ensemble?
It's so important because you need. For me, growing up, I went to Whitefish Bay. I went through that school system and had a wonderful opportunity. But going to plays downtown or seeing plays at my school, I didn't see people that looked like me on stage. What I did see was my brother, who also attended Whitefish Bay as well. So when I think of someone who lives in 53206, who wants to be an actor, they need access. And so, yes, you come see Fences. Yes, you come see Dreamgirls at the Rep. But then what are you going to do in February or in January or throughout the rest of the year? We want to make sure that there are ample opportunities, various opportunities for African Americans and just citizens of Milwaukee to see the arts through the Black lens, through, and we're all Americans, so it's a part of that American story, and it's important that everyone has access to it.
So you mentioned some, you know, big productions that also come with a big ticket price and involve going to, you know, a downtown theater. Are there ways that you feel that Bronzeville Arts Ensemble can help bring the arts out into the community and maybe at a lower price point so that it's more accessible to people, both that they feel that it's theater for them and they can afford to go?
Oh, absolutely. I'm hoping that it can be free, actually. And I'm new to this. I'm an actor by trade, and I've been lovingly pushed into this arts leadership position. And so I am calling on all of my mentors, all of the great arts leaders we have in Milwaukee, and finding ways to connect with funders and with other organizations who are willing to fight this good fight with us, so that we can offer plays in the park in the summer, so that we can drive busloads of people from 53206 to see not just Fences maybe, but then also our production as well, to offer deep discounts. Those are my goals. I feel like art should be free and accessible, and of course that, you know, that can be difficult. But whatever way we're able to do that, whether it's partnering with the recreation department, and having those plays in the park, or going to the schools, we're going to find ways to do that.
And you talked about the fact that you're an actor by trade, and here you are learning all of the behind-the-scenes things that it takes to put on a performance. Are you looking to other African-American cultural organizations, music or dance organizations, for how they've been able to survive and thrive?
Oh, absolutely. You have the Black Arts Think Tank in Milwaukee, a wonderful umbrella organization that houses Kofi Hansberry Sands and African American Children's Theater, and Candace and Diane, they have definitely been supporters for us, and we definitely pull on their knowledge, and then we also are working with a professor out of UW-Madison, Sandra Adele, who is a professor of literature. So we're working with her as well, and there are other, you know, it's, we're trying to get around and get to everyone, so I'm meeting a lot of new people as well. So I have a long checklist of art organizations and arts leaders and just community leaders who I am trying to sit down and chat with about our organization and see if there's a way to partner with them.
So tell us about the first show that you'll be performing in the new space as part of this collaboration with the Milwaukee Rep.
So we are producing The Mojo and The Say-So. It is a collaboration with Theater Leela, a Madison-based theater company. This production is written by Aisha Rahman. And this is about a family who is dealing with, several years later now, the death of their 10-year-old son, who was mistakenly killed by a white police officer. And with some compassion, humor, and a touch of fantasy, this play, it shows the aftermath of this tragedy and how this family has moved on in this now new opportunity presented in the play for them to heal these wounds.
And how large a cast is it?
So we have four wonderful actors
One actor is in our ensemble, Marvette Knight, and Gavin Lawrence, who has performed in Milwaukee at First Stage and Milwaukee Rep, and new to Milwaukee, Wigasi Brandt and Isaiah Phillips.
And when will you be staging that?
So the production will be January 28th through the 31st in the Steamkey Studio here at Milwaukee Rep.
Well, Malkia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Malkia Stampley is the producing artistic director for the Bronzeville Arts Ensemble, and she was discussing their production company's new partnership with the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. They will be staging their first production in January.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickard.
It's time for Food Friday. Cookbooks can be a great resource and a great read, but what makes one really stand out from the rest? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Tell us your favorite cookbook, maybe the one you always go back to. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now is Anna Thomas-Bates. She's a freelance writer who blogs at TallGrassKitchen.com. She also writes a weekly column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section, and she writes for Edible Medicine and for Brava Magazine. Anna, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
So, in your opinion, what makes a great cookbook?
Well, first and foremost, well-tested recipes. Every once in a while, you bump into a cookbook that maybe didn't spend as much time testing its recipes as it should have, but when they work, they're great. I also love head notes with great stories, and wonderful photography is always a bonus too.
And is it how a cookbook is organized and laid out important for how useful it is?
You know, it is, but these days you see almost everything. You see some that are organized by season, others that are organized by, you know, what type of meal it is. So you really see everything, and especially since there's so many different types of cookbooks these days, ones that are, you know, span the gamut of everything, and others that are focused on a single ingredient or a single type of food.
I definitely notice when there is not a good index in the back,
because
to be able to go and see, well, I've got some corn. What do you got for corn? And if there's not a good index, I'm not too likely to use that.
Very true. That's extremely helpful.
Now, Anna, I'm kind of ruthlessly practical when it comes to cookbooks. I want to use them to cook things, but a lot of them are for reading, and they have stories and travel experiences, stuff like that. Is that fun? Do you enjoy that kind of backstory? A cookbook as literature?
I do. I read them as books. I sit down at night, I get a cup of tea or a cocktail, and I'll sit down and read them. I love it.
And looking at how a cookbook is organized, or kind of the production value, how important do you think photos are in a cookbook?
You know, they're a definite bonus. I love to have them because visually I like to read the ingredients of a recipe and see a picture, and it helps me get an idea of what I'm about to embark on. But I'm not going to hold it against a cookbook. And a lot of cookbooks these days are doing really cool things with, you know, almost comic book graphics or illustrations. So there's lots of different designs.
We're talking about cookbooks. You can share your favorite cookbook, your go-to cookbook, at 800-642-1234, as we talk to Anna Thomas-Bates, blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. And we'll go to a caller now with Marie in Genesee. Marie, hi.
Hi.
Oh, what's your cookbook, Marie?
It's called An Occasion to Gather, and it's from the Milwaukee Junior League.
And tell us about it. Why is this a good cookbook?
Every recipe that I have ever tried, it comes out perfect. And we were talking about pictures, and their graphics are beautiful, and you actually see what you're going to end up with.
Marie, thank you so much for sharing that one. And Anna, she said the recipes come out perfect. And I don't know, all cookbooks maybe aren't created equal. We've talked to people from America's Test Kitchen mm-hmm. about how they try to account for what the user might actually do with their recipe. Is there a big variety of outcome from one cookbook to another?
You know, there is, and since I write recipes myself in my cooking column, you have to write things very carefully and test them very carefully, but there's also a lot of differentiation in people's ovens and the weather and ingredients. So I spend a lot of time on email answering questions and helping people out, and sometimes it's just user error. They thought they were really doing it right, but, you know, there's just certain tweaks. But well-tested recipes are definitely a must, and America's Test Kitchen is always a classic go-to.
Let's go back to the phones, and Gigi in Madison is up next. Hi, Gigi.
Hi.
Hi. What's your favorite cookbook?
The A to Z Max Sacks Cookbook.
And what is that exactly?
Ben Hunter's Brussels Sprouts.
Ah, and so is Ben Hunter's Brussels Sprouts your favorite recipe in that book?
Yes, it is.
And what do you like about it? Because you sound like maybe you're a kid. How old are you, Gigi?
9 years old.
So I have to say, I'm guessing there are a lot of 9-year-olds who Brussels sprouts would not be their favorite recipe. What is it about Ben Hunter's Brussels sprouts that you love?
Well, I love the taste because you use apple cider vinegar. Oh. And I, not apple cider vinegar, apple cider
oh.
for it. And it just has this really sharp flavor with the crunchiness of the Brussels sprouts. And I really, really like that because I like the texture and I like the taste.
And so, do you cook them yourself?
I do most of the cooking, and my mom helps me.
Well, you sound like a chef in the making. You seem to have a really good palate since you're bringing in that acidity, and you like texture with the crunch. So, bravo!
Thank you.
Thanks, Gigi. Well, actually, Gigi brought up a great point because one of my favorite cookbooks I was telling Rob earlier is called The Cook-Along Book, and I got it when I was probably about Gigi's age, and it shows there are many, many stains, and some of the pages are stuck together, and they're very basic but really good recipes, and I still go back to do the beef stew recipe. They actually have a recipe for making your own pancake mix, which I've kind of fancied up and I actually use to give as gifts. And it's a great cookbook, and it actually makes me laugh every time I use it because in the middle of a recipe, all of a sudden in all caps, it'll say, be careful with that knife, or make sure you ask for help with that hot pot, or have you washed your hands recently? It's a kid's cookbook, but it's a really great go-to basic cookbook.
I love that story, and it's just it's such a feeling of empowerment for kids to have some control over the menu and the recipes you're choosing, not to mention helping with the cooking.
And Anna, before we go back to our callers, I want to ask you to name some names here. What are a couple of your favorite cookbooks to sit down and read, for one, with that coffee or cocktail, depending on the time of day, and your favorite ones to cook with?
Oh, well, my cookbook is a little, excuse me, my collection is a little embarrassing. I have into the hundreds of cookbooks, and I love them. So I always get the new ones because they come out in spring and fall. And for new ones this year, the one that I wrote about in my column last week is a cookbook called Near and Far by Heidi Swanson. And Heidi Swanson is a blogger out of San Francisco, and her blog is called 101 Cookbooks, and she has beautiful photography, and she's vegetarian. And her recipes are very simple and well-written, but they have such surprising combinations, things that you'd think, why didn't I think of this before? But you really never did think of it before. And the recipe I featured in my column is called a dried fruit salad, and it has dates and apricots and parsley and olive oil and lemon and salt. And it's just something I never would have put together, but it's delicious.
Let's go back to the phones, and Jennifer in Columbus joins us. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Hi.
I have my favorite cookbooks to use are the ones from the Church Cookbooks or Kiwanis Club or Lions Club. You know, something where you have many contributors, but they're the ordinary people contributors. I love them because the people don't contribute a recipe unless it is their favorite and it is a no-fail recipe.
I love those too, Jennifer, and I love just the whole history behind just the Junior League cookbook mentioned before, and the Church cookbooks, and the Company cookbooks. There's such history and so much realness there, and they're a lot of fun to read. And I like to go find my grandmother's and my parents' old ones and find there's a lot of fun recipes and history there.
Yeah, on the Central Time Facebook page, we've got links to a couple of archives, one here at UW, one I think at Michigan State it was, with a lot of older cookbooks. I was thumbing through them online, and they've got, you know, some that are typewritten, some that are handwritten recipes, some of Bucky Badger's favorite foods, I think circa 1955 among them. That tells us a story not just about food, but about the people who contribute those recipes, don't they, Anna?
It does. through the way the recipes are written, the actual design and layout of the books, through the ingredients, you can really see it's really a reflection or a snapshot of that time and age. It's really fascinating.
And so you said you have a couple hundred cookbooks. I'm guessing there are some that are in a more frequent rotation, but, you know, how do you use them? Or are they partly just friends you have sitting near you?
Structural support, load-bearing cookbooks.
I don't own stock in this company, but last year I discovered a website called eatyourbooks.com. And basically what they've done is they've indexed cookbooks. And so if you buy a subscription, and I believe it's $35 a year, you can input all the titles of your collection, and then it becomes a searchable database of all the recipes that you have in your cookbook. So I can type in roasted chicken, and it will give me a list of all the roasted chicken recipes in my cookbooks. And the recipe isn't in there. You still have to physically go get the book and look it up, but it'll tell you which book there's a recipe in and the basic ingredients in that book, so you can see if it's one you want to dive into. So I can say that that has vastly increased the use of my cookbooks.
I think a lot of people just perked up their ears at this concept. What's the name of that again?
It's eatyourbooks.com.
Eatyourbooks.com.
It's, somebody's ears perked up here, Judith.
Yeah.
I usually don't shill for things, but it is fantastic and really helps me get kind of my money's worth from my cookbooks. And the other thing I like to do, and this my husband laughs at me, is I will kind of set a goal that I'm going to either cook from a new book every day for a week, or I'll take one book and cook from that for the week and just kind of make that my go-to and just dive into it and really explore it. And also when I first get books, I go through it immediately and I sticky note stuff that catches my eye so I can pick something up a couple months later and know that there's five or six recipes that I was already interested in.
We're talking about what makes a great cookbook and why they can be so much fun to look through, and we'd like to hear from you. Do you have a go-to cookbook that you couldn't cook without? What is it? What makes it so good? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post and find some interesting reference material on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation with food writer Anna Thomas Bates about what makes a cookbook great, and we'd like to hear from you.
What is your favorite cookbook? How did you find it? Do you have a lot of cookbooks, like Anna? Or do you have just a couple that you use a lot all the time? Call 800-642-123 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right back to our callers with John in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First off, I would like to say that Anna sounds a lot like my wife. My wife is always buried in a cooking book in the evening. And our favorite cookbook right now, at least, is Julia Child's The Way to Cook. And that's just a classic, but we love it because it has, like, one technique for whitefish and then ways to tweak it. So it really just shows you, you know, the full technique of what you're doing and then gives you lots of ideas to play on from that.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Julia Child, a classic there. Anna, how many of hers are in your collection?
Oh, I have quite a few. She's amazing. And her, and also kind of a good friend of hers who's still around today, is Dory Greenspan. And they both write recipes in a similar way. They give you lots of information on technique, but you can tell that they want you to really learn it and then make that recipe your own. I feel like nothing would make them happier than to know you made their recipe so many times and made enough tweaks that you may have even forgotten where it originally came from.
And actually, her partner in crime on PBS, Jacques Pepin, has a brand new cookbook out just this fall called, I believe, Heart and Soul in the Kitchen.
Yes, he does, and I love him as well.
We'll go back to our callers. Abigail is on the line in Brooklyn. Abigail, hi.
Hi. One of my favorite cookbooks, and I like to give it as gifts often, is The New Vegetarian Epicure by Anna Thomas, and that's one that I've read cover to cover many times because she recreates all of her, it's by menu, and she recreates each menu and describes what it meant to her, and it's really fun to read, and all the recipes are great, not just for vegetarians either, of course.
And did this help get you into cooking, Abigail?
Yes, I checked it out from the library when I was 15, and I read it in one night, and I've been cooking ever since. I actually was a professional cook for 5 years when I was old enough.
Abigail, thank you so much. Great story. And the library reminds me, Anna, that that's how I've done a lot of my cookbook finding. I'll check it out from the library and, you know, I'll get maybe an Indian cookbook and learn how to do a couple basic things. Then I've got that in my repertoire, and that's probably all I'll take out of it. But that's a great way to to try out those cookbooks.
It is, and a lot of times if there's a cookbook not there, a lot of libraries are looking for suggestions as well as to what you might like to see them order, but it's a good way to preview a book or just give it a try.
And Anna, should we say that you, Anna Thomas Bates, are not Anna Thomas of the New Vegetarian Epicure?
That is true. Anna Thomas is a great vegetarian author, and I think she wrote one called Love Soup not too long ago that is a favorite of mine that has some beautiful recipes in it. And it's a good point, just bringing her up. And Deborah Madison is another cook who cooks primarily vegetarian, but that shouldn't stop other people from getting the books. Those two are so talented that, you know, Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone by Deborah Madison is probably one of my most often used cookbooks because it really has a great way to cook everything from waffles to soups, and it goes through almost every vegetable you can think of and a few great ways to prepare them.
Let's go back to the phones, and Russ joins us from Monroe. Hi, Russ.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The book that I use often isn't so much a cookbook. It's called Culinary Artistry, and I think one of the authors was Doran or something. But what it is a compilation of everything that goes with everything else and the basic ingredients in many different cuisines. So if you could look up chicken, it will tell you the things that, you know, go with chicken, which would be an awful lot. But there's very specific things that these are things that go well. These are spices that go well. These are other vegetables that pair well. And it also it defines different cuisines where you can go and say Taiwanese, you know, is mostly, you know, garlic, ginger, and scallions. So I use it as like a way to, if I'm creating something, I can go, okay, or let's say I have a piece of fish. I can go in and say, well, what goes great with this piece of fish? And it'll list all these different things, and some you never think of.
I'm glad you brought that one up. It's actually by Karen Page and her husband, Andrew Dornenberg, and they wrote Culinary Artistry, and they also wrote the Flavor Bible and the Vegetarian Flavor Bible, and it's like your next-level cookbook. And just like the caller said, you can look up almost any ingredient and find all the flavors that complement it, and it's a great resource. A lot of bartenders, a lot of chefs have all of these on their shelves, and they use these to kind of create new recipes, tweak recipes. You know, you can look up something like, you know, pheasant or cinnamon and just see what are all the great things that go with those things. And it's a really handy tool if you're ready to start cooking kind of without a book or a recipe.
Russ, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Anna Thomas Bates about cookbooks, what makes a good cookbook. And we're hearing your favorites at 800-642-1234. Barbara's with us next in Waupaca. Barbara, hi.
Hello. The book that I like very much is a book that I found in a used bookstore, and the title of it is Candy Hits by Sizzu Pitts. Hello?
Candy Hits. Okay, thank you. So it's a candy-making cookbook, Anna. Do you have any good, that's a specialized one, do you have any favorite candy-type cookbooks?
You know, I don't think I have any that are specifically candy. I have a ton of dessert and cookies and cakes and kind of general desserts, but nothing just for candy. And I couldn't quite hear the caller as to what the title was.
Candy Hits, H-I-T-S. So these are ones that are surefire hits, I guess. Candy Hits.
That sounds like one to look up.
We had a caller, John, in Madison, who said he's learning about vegan cooking using Angela Liddon's Oh, She Glows cookbook. He says there are excellent soups, stews, and desserts, and you wouldn't even think they were vegan.
Yeah, there's for all the different ways people are eating today, there are lots and lots of cookbooks to help them achieve their goals. There's lots of vegan cookbooks out right now. Last year was a huge year for vegan cookbooks. There's a lot of paleo cookbooks coming out this year, a lot of gluten-free. So if you're interested in experimenting with some of those recipes, there's some very talented authors who can kind of get you going down the right path. And even if you're not eating that way, I think it's a nice way to shake things up a little bit, try something new, and, you know, just mix it into your repertoire once or twice a week even.
Well, that's a great use for a cookbook when you're kind of exploring uncharted territory, whether it's a new dietary restriction or lifestyle choice or a new ethnic style of cooking. And I used to try this. I tried to recreate, you know, Indian, I'll say again, restaurant food at home without recipes. It was horrible. So that, that cookbook is a way to get in there and start figuring out the basics.
Yeah, and especially for things like the Asian and the Indian and Moroccan, there's just there's spice combinations and different spices that you might not have thought about. And with our incredible grocery stores these days and the spice stores, you can get your hands on a lot of those specialty ingredients, and then you can really do some amazing recreations at home.
So,
it's a great, great way to travel abroad without taking a plane.
So, Anna, there are a lot of food-focused holidays on the horizon. Are there some cookbooks that you really like for maybe new twists on old favorites or dishes that are going to please a crowd?
Sure. For kind of classic holiday stuff, I actually go back a lot to my old magazine recipes, which aren't cookbooks, but from Bon Appetit and Food and Wine. They just have some really amazing classic holiday recipes. And if you're looking for something trendy, then a lot of the newer food sites who have put out cookbooks like Food 52 are great ways to get those classics with maybe a little bit of a twist or a different technique. And then if you're really looking, especially if this is like your first Thanksgiving dinner, America's Test Kitchen is a great way to get all those sides and all those classics done easy as possible with kind of no-fail recipes.
Anna, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That's Anna Thomas-Bates. She's a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. She writes a weekly column at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel food section. You can keep sharing your favorite cookbooks at the Central Time Facebook page. This is a special day for me as a saxophonist. Today is the birth anniversary of Adolf Sax, as in saxophone. The Belgian musical inventor was born on this day in 1814.
Of course, his most famous and enduring invention was the saxophone, but he did a lot of work on brass instruments. Some of his innovations stayed with us, leading to the development of the flugelhorn and euphonium, but the sax tuba, the saxotromba, and the sax horn are sadly no longer with us.
He's kind of like the, you know, we had Les Paul here in Wisconsin, the Wizard of Waukesha, this incredible inventor, designer of all this music stuff, technology. He was the Les Paul of his era there in Belgium. But the saxophone, I'd like to say, has been a success story.
Well, and actually, I got to visit the Museum of Music in Paris, and they had a lot of those early prototypes of the sax tuba and saxophone and things like that. They look a little funky these days, a little twisty, curvy, hard to play, but, you know, variety's the spice of life.
All right, well, we'll go out to the news with one of my saxophone role models. I wish I could play like him, Maceo Parker of James Brown Band fame and beyond.
And coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll get the latest on the biggest headlines from around the state this week in our Wisconsin News Roundup. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.